Well, good morning, and it is good to see you here, and greetings to those joining us at home, Crossroads Highland Park, Vernon Hills, the 01. So, I know it has been a particularly challenging week, at least in the Lake Forest congregation, so I just want to acknowledge that, as others have. Some weeks, I mean, I'm aware that people come in here from very different weeks. And some week you're the windshield, and some week you're the bug. And there was a lot of people that were the bug this week in sad ways and hard ways. And so whatever you need today, that is always my prayer. Those, some of you need hope and peace and some ability to find resilience to sort of face the next week. Some people need, correction. Some people need to hear from God. Some people need an experience with God. And so I am fully incapable of any of that. And I always pray, Lord, do in people's hearts what needs to be done. So just want to start there. And then I want to ask you a question. What do you think Jesus wants for you? What do you think God wants for you? What do you think Jesus prays for you, wants you to have? When he thinks of you, prays this. Jesus is our high priest. Right, so a priest is the person who stands between people and God, representing the people. Jesus is also a prophet. A prophet stands between God and the people, representing God. Jesus is the greatest prophet. Jesus is our high priest. He is also king, but as priest, he intercedes on our behalf. He prays for you. He represents you to the Father. And so, what do you think he's asking that the Father would give to you? What does Jesus want for you? I am assuming you know what you want for you, right? Not always. We're not always quite as self-aware as we might think. But there are things that you pray for, whether it is very formally or you just aspire for. There are things that you want that you think would make your life better or make you better. What do you think Jesus wants for you? What does Jesus pray for you? Now, I mean, this is a trick question because it's in the text, right? We're reading the high priestly prayer, where this is week 11 in this 19-week series in which we're going through the second half of John, which means we're going through the last week of Christ's life. And we've now come he has less than a day to live. He has spent this week with his disciples. He's talked with them about love, and he's washed their feet, and he's sort of told them that things are going to get hard, and he keeps saying to them that he's going to be with them. Don't worry, the train is about to jump the tracks, but I've got this, and I'm caring for you. I'm sending the Holy Spirit for you. So it's been this intense sort of teaching time. We call it the farewell discourse. We now have come to the end. So by some miracle of the Holy Spirit inspiration, we're able to hear what the disciples don't hear. We're able to listen in as God the Father and God the Son communicate. So the next thing to happen is going to be Jesus' arrest. And then from there, it goes very quickly. He'll be on a cross very quickly. So this is sort of, he will pray. He will pray at other times. He'll pray on the cross. And we've got lots of examples of Jesus praying, right? Throughout the New Testament, we see Jesus praying for children, and Jesus prays before the feeding of the 5,000 and after the feeding of the 5,000, and he prays. I mean, there's lots of examples of Jesus praying. But we never really get to listen in very much to what he prays for. And in this case, this is sort of really the Lord's Prayer. The Lord's Prayer that we call the Lord's Prayer is what he taught in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 5 or 6, where he says, when you pray, pray like this, our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. He teaches the disciples how to pray that prayer. That's not the prayer Jesus would have prayed, because he's not asking for forgiveness of sins. This is a model for us to pray. The actual Lord's Prayer, the prayer that Jesus prays, is what we get right now in John chapter 17. And what we get here is Jesus praying for us. And it's very rich, and it's very, there's in this one chapter, there's an Irish pastor who preached 45 sermons out of John chapter 17. And Martin Lloyd-Jones, who's considered by many to be one of the greatest preachers ever in the English-speaking language, he wrote 4 books on John chapter 17. So this is a rich, rich, rich section. I'm focusing on just a few verses here and one particular topic. And I am focusing on this particular topic because it speaks to, selfishly, it speaks to part of my job description. And I have to think about this a lot, and so I'm forcing you to think about it today. Verse 20 of John chapter 17, my prayer is not for them alone. He's talking to God the Father, and when he says them, he's talking about the disciples, the apostles. He's been praying for them, but now he says, my prayer is not for them alone. I pray also for those who will believe in me through their message, which would be everybody else, including us, right? So everybody who has come to faith through the message of the disciples and the church that they're going to launch in just a little bit. So that's us. I pray that all of them may be one, Father, just as you are in me and I am in you. May they also be in us so that the world may believe that you have sent me. So he's praying for our closeness to God the Father and God the Son, and he's praying for our closeness to each other. I have given them the glory that you gave me, that they may be one as we are one, I and them and you and me, so that they may be brought to complete unity. Then the world will know that you sent me and have loved them even as you have loved me. So Jesus prays for our unity. He does not pray for the disciples that they will be spared what's going to happen to them. And of the 11 disciples that are left, Judas has already left to betray Jesus. So of the 11 that are left in the room, all 11 are going to be persecuted. 10 of the 11 are going to be martyred for their faith. He does not pray. They spare them from that. He does not pray for them or for us that we would have an easy life. He doesn't pray that we'll get ahead. He doesn't pray, the kinds of things that perhaps you pray. And please understand, I mean, the Psalms, if nothing else, make it clear. We ought to pray for what we want. Pray for what you want. Oftentimes, I find in the act of praying for what I want that I then have to say, yeah, that's pretty shallow. Whatever it would be best, I guess that's really what I want. No, what I really want is that. I think that's what I want, but yeah, no, that's pretty shallow. So, but the very act of sort of being aware of what's going on in our heart, praying for what I want, we're not told not to do that. But his prayer is for our unity. Emphasis on our. He's not praying that everyone everywhere will get along, although that would be wonderful. I mean, it would be wonderful if everybody got along. It would be wonderful if there was no war. It would be wonderful if there was no tension. That would be wonderful, but that's not what he's praying for. That is ultimately, in the end, promised there will be a world in which God's kingdom will come and God's rule will be done. So we look forward to that day, but that's not what he's praying for here. He's praying that we are going to be able to get along with each other. And he uses the perfect relationship that exists between God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Spirit as the template for how we should be in some sort of perfect relationship. And then he prays that this will happen so that, he's got a very specific agenda. He says, God, I'm praying for this so that those on the outside looking in will take notice that this group of people who otherwise don't appear to have everything in common are finding ways to love and care for each other. And wow, wouldn't I like to be part of something like that? So, what do we do with this? What does this mean for us? How do we think about this? Well, for starters, it's pretty clear that if we're going to pull this off, getting along with the person you're sitting next to, and the person across the way, and in a church like this, you know, one church with four campuses and nine services, it sort of select amongst themselves about which campus and which service people go to. But this is a bigger call than that, and it means if this is going to happen, then our identity is going to have to first and foremost be in Jesus. That is going to have to be more primary to how you think about yourself than political ideology, ethnic identity, socioeconomic status, even whatever bracket-based, fan-fueled allegiance to a particular college basketball team is driving you to love X and hate Y, right? That somehow our identity has to primarily be as a Christ follower. I'm not saying that those other categories are wrong or that we can't also have some sense of who we are and who God has made us in light of all that, but the emphasis clearly has to be on our identity as Jesus. So what he has said to them, don't forget, on the night that he was betrayed, that's this night, he has gathered them together and says, a new commandment I give to you. All right. You shall love the Lord your God. You shall love your neighbor. And that's, in one sense, not new. But then he adds this on, as I have loved you. Right, that now becomes the new information. That's the new bar, the new, what does love look like? It looks like this guy who's about to go give up his life for us. And of course, we know there is no greater act of love than dying for somebody else. And so he is setting out this remarkable standard. So some people think the way to get along in the church is to find a church that is full of people with whom you get along, which means you find a church that looks and thinks and votes like you do, that likes the kind of music that you do, that is convenient for you. But that's not at all what Jesus is talking about. Let's not forget, he does this crazy thing of gathering together in the initial group somebody who is a tax collector and somebody who is a zealot. So tax collector means, this is Matthew, means that they have joined ranks with the Romans. They have sold out their people. Tax franchises were bid out by the Romans to people. So you said, oh, out of this group of my family, out of my family and friends, I think I can get you $1 million. And so if that's what you thought you could get and that was the highest amount, then the Romans gave it to you. Then you went out to try and raise, $2 million and you got to keep the second million, Right, so tax collectors were really despised because they're partnering with the oppressive government in that particular way. They have capitulated. On the other end of the spectrum, you have Simon, who is a zealot. He's a guerrilla. He's a revolutionary. He has sworn to take down Rome. Like, he's not partnering with them. He's trying to undermine them, right? So you have got, in that moment, you've got both ends of the political spectrum here. And Jesus says, look, what is going to unite us is going to be so much more important and defining that it is going to bridge those gaps. So I think a lot about this because, as you know, the last few years have been a little rough out there and in here with all kinds of divisions over all kinds of issues, political and cultural and ethnic and approaches to science and masks and viruses and government mandates and everything else. And a few years ago, before COVID hit, there were some people who I really think are smart who said, there will be no purple churches going forward. There will be red churches and there will be blue churches, but there will be no purple churches. And I thought, oh, wow. I don't want to hear that because we're purple about three different ways. First of all, we're purple because a lot of people politically, and this was just a political comment, it wasn't meant to be, you know, beyond that, but they was talking in the context of politics. We're purple in the sense that there's a lot of people who identify themselves as purple. They would just say, I'm not red, I'm not blue, or I'm light red, or I'm light blue, whatever, but I'm more in the middle than I am on either side. So we've got that. We're also purple in the sense that we've got people who are dark red, and we've got people that are dark blue. I generally try and keep them apart from each other. You may not... If it looks like I'm doing sort of crowd control and you know, air traffic control and trying to keep people away from each other. So we've got that. And then we've also got this conviction that purple would be okay. Right? I mean, that this is not what defines us. Now, it's crazy out there, and as both parties sort of move for various reasons to extreme positions, it gets crazier out there. And I'm not making any political comments right now. I'm simply saying that that we understand politically, culturally, ethnically, socioeconomically, all these things, that the church is supposed to be this community in which a surprising group of people gather. Like, oh, well, what? Why would they spend time together? I don't put those people together. Why are they together? Oh, they're together because of this common defining bond in Jesus. So what unites us is supposed to be more significant than anything else about us. And that just creates some challenges for a variety of people. And as I said, very selfishly, chiefly me, because I do consider part of my assignment to protect the unity of the church. Jesus, before he's dying, in this final words, in a sense, like, this is what I'm most concerned about. This is what I'm worried about. Father, this is what I'm asking for. Keep them united. I think, okay, that seems like there's instruction there for me and for you. I don't know. Do you pray for unity with other Christians? Like, this is what Jesus prays for you. Do you pray for yourself for unity? Now, there's a lot that is written about unity. Because unity in the church, because there's 2,000 years of trouble maintaining unity. And the trouble, just for the record, it starts in the church in the book of Acts. So one of the first little moments of this is you've got a fallout between Paul and Peter that leads to the Jerusalem Council in Acts chapter 15. So Paul has been out taking the gospel to the Gentiles. And so he's out telling people that, hey, there's a relationship available to you with God through the work of Jesus Christ. And it is a gracious invitation that is extended to you. And Paul is being heckled by a bunch of people who are saying, yeah, but not completely that simple. You have to become a Jew first, and you have to keep all these Jewish rules and ceremonial rules and observances. They're called the Judaizers. Paul writes about them in Philippians. He calls them the dogs, right? He doesn't like them. So this is causing a problem, and so they come back. Paul and Barnabas come back off the mission field, and they meet with all the apostles in Jerusalem, Acts chapter 15, and they work this out. And the division becomes a division between Paul and Peter. And Peter's wrong, and this is important, and Paul prevails. Then Paul and his number two, Barnabas, have a falling out over something that's not that important, whether or not John Mark, who writes the Gospel of Mark, whether or not John can go with them. Mark can go with them. Paul says no. He's mad at Mark. And Paul says, oh, good grief, grow up and let's take this young man with us. And you got to think Barnabas is right and Paul is wrong, but they go their separate ways. So we've got conflict in the church from, you know, right shortly after the church got started. And then you just read through the rest of the New Testament and you see that there's all these other situations that speak to conflict. In Philippians, I think chapter 4, Paul says, or it might be 3, I urge Euodia and I urge Syntyche to live in harmony with each other. Help them work out their conflict. And then in Galatians 3, you've got this. In Christ, there is no Jew nor Greek, no male nor female, no slave nor free. And he's saying that because they're dividing up that way, right? And so he's saying, no, these divisions are wrong. And then in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 10, he talks about the need. I'm praying that you will find a way to not divide so that you will be unified, because this is important. So we see a lot in the New Testament that has been written about the need for the church to be one. So what do we do with this? That was the question. What do we do with this call to unity? Well, I think we have to ask three immediate questions. Number one, who am I supposed to be unified with? Number two, what exactly do we have to agree on? And number three, how do you suggest we do this? Okay. So the first thing, I already mentioned a little bit of this, in John chapter 17, this prayer, Jesus says, I pray not just for them, the apostles, I pray for everybody that's going to believe in them, make them one. So he's not praying for people outside the church, he's praying for people who have declared their allegiance to Jesus Christ. I'm praying that those who have said that they are my disciples, those that have trusted me, I'm praying that you will keep them unified. So we then step back and say, okay, does that mean that, is the call there that the churches ought to be unified? So just in context, initially there's only a church. There's one church. There's lots of different congregations, but there is one church, and there's a bishop who's in charge of a certain area, and in different towns there would be various churches. And there's no buildings. Remember, it's illegal to be a Christian. You couldn't build a building, buildings don't come along for 300 years. So they're meeting in people's houses, so that's gonna limit the size of the churches. They're small group-ish, or maybe slightly bigger than that, but not much bigger. And there's different small groups, different house churches, and in an area, but they're all together, and there's one bishop that's in charge of them. So the church will grow, and you know, Constantine, and the Christianity becomes legal, and then it grows, and we go into the Middle Ages, also called Christendom, and things get much bigger. In the 11th century is the first big historic split, and it's called the Great Schism, and it happens between the what is the church in the eastern part of the Roman Empire and the church in the western part of the Roman Empire. So the eastern part of the Roman Empire ends up being called the Orthodox churches, capital O. So you hear of the Greek Orthodox and the Russian Orthodox, right? The Ethiopian Orthodox churches. And then the western side ends up being called the Catholic Church. Catholic is a term for universal. And the split takes place. They argue and end up going their separate ways. The presenting argument is the use of icons in worship. But the real issue is who's got power, who's in control. And the Orthodox, the Eastern churches are saying, we think all the bishops are the same and we got to work this out together. And the Western church had organized around this claim that the Bishop of Rome was preeminent. And so you've got this division that happens in the 11th century. And then later on in the 16th century, the church in the West, from which we have come, is going to reform. There's going to be a disruption. This is Martin Luther, 1517, nailing the 95 Theses on the door of the Castle Church in Wittenberg, Germany, and saying the church is corrupt and it's got to reform. And that is going to eventually lead to the Protestant Reformation. And then the Protestant churches are going to further divide. And you're going to have not just the Lutherans, but the Calvinists. And then you're going to have the Anabaptists. And then you're going to have all kinds of the Church of England. And there's a sense in which the Christ Church Lake Forest comes out of the Church of England after it divides, and you get the Puritans, and then you've got different kinds of Puritans. And so we have found ways to divide, let me say that. According to Todd Johnston in his book, World Christianity, there are 30,000 different denominations in the world right now. Probably more than that, because it was a couple years old. But it's not as bad as it sounds in the sense that the denominations said, we are going to agree that we agree on all the things that matter, right? Sort of the Apostles' Creed. We agree on all those things. There's a bunch of things that we agree are not of critical importance that we disagree. So are we going to have a bishop in charge of church government? Or are we going to have elders? Or are we going to have a congregational vote? Are we going to baptize infants? Or are we not going to? Are we going to meet only on Sunday? Or are we going to meet on Saturday? I mean, there's a whole bunch of things. And we say, the denominations basically are supposed to say, we agree on the things that matter. And I'm only going to say good things about you. But we disagree on things that are secondary. So that's sort of what gives birth to the denominational emphasis. And here's the thing. We will tonight at the Lake Forest campus, there's going to be 13 churches coming together for this worship night and baptism. And I spend a fair bit of my time now that I'm now like the old guy in the area and I've been the pastor longer than anyone else. I spend a lot of my time. We spend our resources trying to invest in other churches. We want gospel-centered churches to grow and to thrive. We want to see them move forward. So we are fans of churches, and we want to see other churches thrive, and so we're working that side of it. And for the most part, most of you don't have anything to say about whether churches are going to get along or not. Your challenge is to get along, again, with the person sitting next to you, who voted for somebody that you think is crazy. So that's your challenge. Who are you supposed to get along with? Christians who are part of the church that you attend. So then the question is, what are we supposed to agree on? Well, generally, we've got this Apostles' Creed mandate, right? That this is the heart of the church. The church also has established other creeds. There's a number of them that are universal creeds, the Nicene Creed, Chalcedonian Definition. I mean, where there's a number of initial creeds that got put forward saying this is the summary of the absolute non-negotiables. When it comes to a local congregation, when I started 23 years ago, I introduced this concept of the fence posts. And I said, look, there are a handful of things that I will fight over. Like, I will fight over the idea that the Bible is our final authority. I will fight over the idea that there's one God and three persons. I'll fight over the idea that we were created in God's image and fallen. I'll fight over the idea that salvation is through Jesus. And it's by grace through faith. There's like six things that make up the six articles of our statement of faith. I said, these I defend. And when you put these fence posts around, there's a safe zone in the middle. And I say, there's a lot of things here where people disagree. You got people that like Coke and people that like Pepsi. You got Green Bay Packer fans and Chicago Bears fans. You got people that say baptism looks like this and baptism doesn't look like this. You've got all kinds of different things here. And I say, yeah, I have opinions on almost all of those things, but I don't really get involved too much in those things, except occasionally to police it and to say, you have said enough about that, you have to sit down because you're causing division. Because this is the safe zone that we're in right here. And it is the essentials of the faith. And that we fight over. Now, there are people here who decide to become members. And at that point, they step up to a higher level of agreement and say, yes, I buy not just the Apostles' Creed and not just these fence posts, but I'm signing on to say, yeah, I think this idea that we want to proclaim the good news and engage in good works, that we want to reach people and renew communities, that we're going to have this mission, right, that we're going to vote on this budget because there's got to be greater alignment around that. I want to be part of that. And so we have membership classes and say, okay, this is a slightly higher bar that you're stepping in to agree. We're still trying to be a very open, but not on these six fence posts for people who come. And those that want to join, we say, this is how we're going to allocate our money, right? This is what the budget's going to look like. We got to get agreement on this. So the question becomes, how do we do this? And I just want to say, I think there's six things that you can do to try and promote unity. Number one, you can pray like Jesus. Right? He prays, keep them one. Father, help them be one. Help them be united. I listened a while back to a sermon series that Andy Stanley did before the election. And he said, look, candidate is going to be decided by who gets the most votes. So your candidate will win or lose based on how many votes they get. The church will win or lose based on how Christians treat each other leading up to the election and afterwards. Because this is what we get called to. We get called to love one another. We get called to unity. We get called to a different level of dialogue. So pray for unity. The second thing that you can do is decide you're not going to be part of division. Right? I mean, when you hear of divisions and you think, oh, that's not over one of the things I'm supposed to be fighting over, then you just go, okay, yeah, I think we disagree over that, but that's okay. Because what unites us is greater than what divides us. Division is easy, right? From the time we're little, we say, it's my rules or I'm taking my ball and I'm going home. Right? Any four-year-old can do that. It's, okay, let's see if we can work out some sort of win-win, or let's see how if I can be a bigger person and we can figure out how to keep going and diffuse. Anybody, I say this to the staff all the time, anybody can take a problem that's a 3 and make it an 8. Your job is to take a problem that's a 6 and make it a 2, right? So we find ways to get along. Number 3, we need to be humble. We need to recognize that we might be wrong in our opinions on all these secondary issues. Good grief. I dare guess some of you have changed your opinions on some of your views over the last 20 or 30 years. And so we recognize, oh, I could be wrong here, and I need to be humble. And what I need to be sure I'm not is the kind of person that Jesus consistently attacked. In this case, it doesn't have to be a conservative, but in this case, it was the religious conservatives who said they were better than everybody else. The Pharisees, right? The Pharisees are the ones that Jesus goes after over and over and over again. So we got to be sure that we are not a Pharisee. We've got to be humble. We cannot think that we're better, smarter than other people. Now, I'm not suggesting a relativism, right? There are things that are non-negotiables. There are things we say, yeah, that's that. I can't bend on that one. But with humility, we can interact on the others. Number four, we need to be wise and avoid getting co-opted by contentious people. So Proverbs, this is Proverbs 101, avoid the fool. This is Matthew, Sermon on the Mount 101, the whole idea of being humble and treating others the way we want to be treated. I'll just simply note this. For about 3 years, and I shared this in various sermons, for about 3 years, I was intentionally listening to both sides of the radio dial. It was just as a discipline. I said, okay, I got to listen to things that I don't agree with to figure out where there may be truth, to figure out what people are hearing. I've got to do this. And I did it for about 3 years, and then I decided I am too old to keep submitting myself to what could lead to a heart attack if I keep listening to some of the things that are being said. And I stopped listening in part because I decided that you cross a line when you declare that evil intentions to other people. So when I'm listening to people say, the reason the other side has this view is because they're evil. I go, no. I can't go there. Confused, wrong, misinformed. Okay. Evil? Like their intentions are evil? Like, no, I have lots of friends that think that. I don't think they're evil. I sometimes think they're wrong. But I decided I'm not going to listen to that because that is leading to division. The fifth thing is to choose to not be offended. I have recommended a book. I have offended a number of people recommending a book called Unoffendable. And the book by Bran Hansen he's a disc jockey. He's a little bit of a comedian. The first 30 pages, you think this is all fluff. There's nothing here. There's no there. It's all fluff. But then I decided, oh no, this is really helpful. And part of what he says is, hey, here's an idea. Choose not to be offended. And I thought, well, that's crazy. And so I went looking for all the verses that said I should be offended when people say things I don't like. I couldn't find those verses. And I started to just decide, oh, I'm just going to not be offended. So I say to people now, like, because people will say, I'm sorry, you know, I think I offended you. And I go, look, here's the deal. I've been a pastor for 35 years. Like, lots of things have been said about me. Unless you're saying really nasty things about my mom, I have just decided I don't care, right? I can't go there. So choose to not be offended. And then the last thing is to recognize your call to love unconditionally people you disagree with. So take somebody on the other side of whatever divide you are seeing and saying, what would it look like for me to love that person unconditionally? The call we get is a radical call. But on the night that he was betrayed, right, in the last moments of Jesus before he gets arrested, he's praying for us that we figure out how to keep it together.